Rated R. It contains violence, adult language, nudity, and adult content.
Good evening, everybody. It is 11 o'clock in the evening, and welcome to the 54th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. We'll be, wrong paragraph. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Thank you for that, and if you don't mind, would you please tell us the name of that song and the artist and the relevance to tonight's topic?
Sure, that was an excerpt from the song that opens the Hell Freezes Over reunion CD from the Eagles called Get Over It. and given what we're discussing this evening, I think it was kind of appropriate, and especially in light of the fact that sometimes we can get over it and sometimes we need a little help. So I thought it'd be kind of a nice, you know, kicking off point for us this evening.
Excellent. Okay, as Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled "He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother: Pathological Functionality," which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recall, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So I thought tonight I would get a piece of trivia history that probably nobody, well, I won't say that, that very few people probably are aware of, although a lot of folks have seen these. So if anyone is familiar with any of the music, that's being played today or anything actually from the 60s, actually anything from the 50s up, particularly if you have seen artists playing Gretsch guitars, or in some cases Lonnie Mack's Flying V, or in some cases Neil Young's Les Paul, or some of the Paul McCartney guitars he plays, or yada yada, you will have seen a Bigsby vibrato stick, or vibrato lever, or whatever you want to call it, and also known as a whammy bar. So that, of course, is named after a guy named, surprisingly enough, Paul Bigsby. So he's a guy that had a really interesting history, from owning a print shop during World War II to being a motorcycle enthusiast. In fact, I think he had his own Indian motorcycle dealership at one time, and was a pretty well-known racer, and you know, had sort of made a name for himself. And eventually ended up meeting a man named Al Crocker, who owned the Crocker Motorcycle Company, and kind of took Bigsby in, and these guys sort of worked on some engines and did some very interesting modifications that still are in existence today. So in the meantime, on the side, Bigsby was both a guitarist and upright bassist. So he played in bands and was looking at guitars and thinking, okay, well, you know, I need to do some stuff in this arena. So he actually starts out, because of his work with metal, with the motorcycles and being a mechanic and all, he started out thinking he was going to make lap steels. So, you know, back in the 40s, those were really, really, you know, big items, the Hawaiian Electric / lap steels. So he was got familiar with a guy named Joaquin Murphy, who was some really hotshot steel player, and made a prototype for him that he just loved, and eventually ended up with a double neck 8-string lap steel, which Murphy just, you know, played like totally all the time and loved it. Loved the original prototype he made for him in the whole nine yards. So, of course, as he's playing, he's a well-known country guy, and as he's playing, all the country artists are seeing and thinking, what the hell is that, and what's he playing, and who made it? So by the late 40s, you know, Bigsby had a number of folks who were, you know, knocking his door down to make him pedal steel instruments. So, you know, he continued to make instruments for Joaquin Murphy and then another gentleman, Speedy West, who was also a really well-known steel player, country steel player, was buying stuff from him. And so part of the unique sound from the steel pedals was that Bigsby made everything himself. He made the pickups himself, wired them, did everything. In fact, instead of using a shoot ton of wires, he used a solid blade, single blade magnet housed in aluminum, and literally did everything himself. So these were literally one-off handmade from start to finish. And, you know, he was really getting a lot of press and a lot of people, you know, interested in his stuff. So when the late 40s came around, he introduced to Merle Travis, who is a well-known country picker. And Travis had a guitar that had I think it was a Kaufman vibrato, but don't quote me on that. And he was constantly bitching about the thing wouldn't stay in tune every time he tried to use the whammy bar, not the strings out of tune. So Bigsby says, hey, I can fix that, which he couldn't. He tried, but it wasn't very successful. However, he said, okay, well, this is going to inspire me to build a better, you know, mousetrap, so to speak. So he works, like, tirelessly trying to get this vibrato that would not knock the strings out of tune. And finally, he ends up doing that and finishes the vibrato in the early 50s, I think 51, and gave it to Travis because he said, you're the guy that inspired me to make this thing because I got so frustrated that I couldn't fix your Kaufman for you that I had to make something that worked. So he dedicated it to Kaufman, which I thought was really cool. In the meantime, you know, then people like Les Paul and other well-known guitarists at the time were going, hey, what's that thing? And I like it. Because they were, you know, saw it on Travis's guitar, and they were like, well, this is great. So they started really getting out there, and then he started making all these Bigsby, got a patent, and in, I think it was in 53, he got a patent for it, maybe 54, I forget. And just, they went wild. And so Leo Fender got a view of it and decided to put it on his Telecaster. And so, you know, the rest is kind of history. It has just gone on to influence a whole bunch of people. And he was originally making the Bigsby's and caught the attention of Ted McCarty, who was president of Gibson Guitars at the time. And he had sort of this, I don't want to say exclusivity contract, but he focused most of his stuff on the Gibson guitars. Even though Lear took his ideas and kind of modified it a bit and to put on his guitars. But he had a contract with Gibson, and eventually Fred Gretsch of Gretsch Guitars contacted him about making a vibrato on the Gretches, and Bigsby says, well, let me check with McCarty and make sure he's not going to be pissed off at me, you know, making Bigsby's vibratos for a competitor company, because Gibson and Gretsch were competitors in certain areas of the market. I thought that was really cool, because, I mean, most people would go, sure, you're paying me a lot of money, and the heck with Ted McCarty, and, you know, but this guy was not that kind of guy. So eventually, this thing really, 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 really took off. And, you know, the rest has sort of been music history. It's been, you know, it's just been voluminously put on everything from, you know, on the planet. The kind of sad note is that during the 60s, he was in such, as his vibratos became so popular, he was wanting to retire because he was just, you know, they're working the crap out of him. He was just inundated with orders. And his family, particularly his daughter, had no interest in taking over the business. She was like, I'm not interested in this shit. So he eventually sold it, I think to hold the rights to Tim McCarthy, I think, in like the mid-60s, and took over the shop. And, of course, then they've licensed it to everybody on the planet. So you have seen this thing in just numbers of guitars. It's on Stephen Stills' White Falcon. It's on, as I mentioned earlier, Neil Young's Les Paul and a bunch of other people's Les Pauls. Brian Setzer's Gretsch, Billy Duffy's White Falcon. So, and Lonnie Mack adapted it for his Flying V. I have to say, and you know, Lonnie's a good guitar player, but I have to say that is the tackiest looking vibrato on his Flying V I've ever seen. If anybody, any of my listeners out there have seen it, you'll probably go, oh, yeah, that thing's disgusting. But it works really well. But anyway, so the Bigsby sort of become legendary. You say that about great many things,
actually.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, but you digress. So,
yes.
In general, and I have to say they are amongst, yeah, and I have to say they're amongst my favorite whammies. I love them. There's a couple of whammies out there that I really like, and Bigsby is definitely in the top three whammies that I just absolutely adore. So I thought I'd give a shout out and a nod to Paul Bigsby, because most people know the whammy when they see it. They don't realize it's a quote unquote Bigsby, but it is. And these are kind of the unsung heroes. So I like to give shouts out to those innovators and unsung heroes. So there you have it.
All right, cool. Thank you for that. Okay, as I mentioned earlier, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. Please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Tonight's show is called He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, Pathological Functionality. Tonight's topic comes out of two articles regarding last Thursday's White House unofficial meeting with the press pool, which starred hip-hop singer Kanye West. And no, I'm not going to call him by his new name. I think the whole thing's dumb, and it's part of the pathology we're going to talk about. One article from the Daily Beast, who is an often sensationalized and hyperbolic second-tier media source, sorry guys, chastising comics and the media for shaming West's problems, even though his behavior has become outrageous, scandalous, and to most who know him personally, a clear indicator that he is in clinical distress of some kind. The other article was from Esquire magazine, left biased but considered much more factual and responsible. And it asserts that, in spirit, that friends, media, and peers have not held West accountable enough, and that much of this happens because he senses he can get away with it and we've proven him right. So what is the real issue here deep down? In terms of societal expectations of autonomy and responsibility, adults in our culture generally fall into one of three categories. First, neurotypical, common functional adult, regardless of the level to which one chooses to embrace and accept this role. Second, chronological adult who is medically and or pathologically unable to independently function or make decisions by themselves, for themselves, and must have the supervision of family, friends, guardians, and or clinicians for the duration of their lives. And three, chronological and legally independent adults who are in between statuses one and two that I just described, usually leaning much further towards number two, but not enough so to have doctors, courts, or society officially reduce or remove their self-determination powers. Parenthetically, this could occur because of physical or mental illnesses, injury, conditions from aging, or other impairments. It can be a subtle and slow process, which is why society and the courts generally hesitate to jump in by force unless and until the person's impaired judgment is causing themselves and or others significant harm. Persons in this category may be mostly functional. For example, maybe they can groom and feed themselves, hold down even complex jobs, and perform many day-to-day tasks. But then simple things such as routine medical self-care, managing social and legal obligations, not being taken advantage of on basic levels, making and managing income, etc., can be too daunting for them. It is this last category that we want to discuss tonight. Responsibility is fairly well defined by the courts and our laws. Accountability by our society and community. But this is less about legal responsibility or even social responsibility, as it is the practical fact that some adults classified as independent are at least sometimes dysfunctionally not so. And sometimes it is directly a result of a mental illness or pathology. And at that point, even if they should be held accountable, can they be? Can they absorb the responsibilities and expectations? And if the answer is no, and the consequences become everyone else's problem, how do we know when to intervene for simple pragmatism's sake? Tonight we will discuss, first, an overview of the recent Kanye West incident as an example of pathologies where those experiencing them inhabit that space, just shy of the loss of independence and responsibility. Second, other examples and discussions of mental illnesses, physical illnesses, and other pathologies that drastically alter behavior and cogency to address it. Third, responsibility, accountability, culpability, and pragmatism. At what point do we, should we, or even can we intervene to save someone from themselves? Beyond the courts and the doctors, what if the person is not functional enough to address their own problems or even be alarmed enough to recognize a problem exists and want to address it? And fourth, how to decide boundaries for yourself regarding others in your life who appear to need intervention. When it's appropriate to try to step in, when one should just leave the person to their consequences, and how to practically do both. And at this point, before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to bring up before we get going.
I'm good, thanks.
All righty. So the first part we're going to talk about is the Kanye West White House incident. Dun, dun, dun. I don't have a lightning and thunder wave, so I'll just have to pretend. Yes. So this is an overview of the recent Kanye West incident as an example of pathologies where those experiencing them inhabit that space just shy of loss of independence and responsibility. So the first take of two is from the Daily Beast. This take on things is primarily about comedians and media taking cheap ad hominem shots at West's manic behavior, which is a valid concern if we assume he is in fact mentally ill and acting out. Parenthetically, I'm not his doctor, but it's extremely likely. It reminds us of similar events in the past involving Charlie Sheen, Martin Lawrence, Britney Spears, and many others who I will name for you in a bit. I'm posting the bulk of both of these articles here to give an example of the extremism of his mania as an example and for context in our further discussions tonight. This stance advocates not taking cheap shots, but does not really speak to his actions or his illness. We certainly don't advocate shaming people who have a mental health problem. So here are some large excerpts from that article. Quote, "Stop Mocking Kanye West's Mental Health" by Marlo Stern of the Daily Beast, 10-12-18. Quote, "To a generation of rap enthusiasts, the Kanye West that stormed into President Trump's Oval Office on Thursday, cloaked in a red MAGA hat, ranting and raving about everything from superheroism to the Unabomber, too power drunk to notice he's being used, is a stranger. Gone is the rabble-rouser who inveighed against police brutality on his song Jesus Walks, who called out homophobia in hip-hop way back in 2005, who denounced former President Bush on national television over his heinous response to Hurricane Katrina, who helped the Kardashian clan accept Caitlyn Jenner's transition, and who once rapped, quote, I'm so appalled, Spalding Ball, balding Donald Trump taking dollars from y'all, end quote. In its stead is a man kneeling at the feet of a demagogue who virulently opposes the peaceful protest of police brutality against Black Americans, wants West's hometown of Chicago to initiate stop and frisk, supports traditional marriage, claims his administration did a fantastic job handling Hurricane Maria, in which 2,900 people died, and has repeatedly tried to ban transgender people from serving in the military. There are two things we know for sure about the Kanye West that showed up at the White House Thursday. He suffers from bipolar disorder, and he is off his medication. Quote, the yay is fully out and off medication. I am fully being myself, West told TMZ last week. These pills that they want me to take three of a day, I take one a week, maybe two a week. Y'all had me scared of myself and my vision. And hours after the Oval Office episode, People magazine reported that those in West's inner circle are telling him that he needs to go back on his medication, that he's not doing well, that he's not making any sense. They further alleged no one close to him can tell him that he's sounding unhinged because his answer is that the President of the United States doesn't think so. So that is the take from the Daily Beast. The next one is from Esquire magazine, and please note that this article has been heavily edited to include commentary from links elsewhere that it referenced in the article. I pulled some of those comments in. So this one is called, It's Time to Hold Kanye West Accountable. He doesn't deserve to come back from this. This is by Malcolm Aime Musoni, and this was also written on October 12th. So this is his quote on it. If you're a good fan or invested enough, you'll attempt to hold him, meaning West, or her accountable when they misstep. He's talking about celebrities in general here. You'll tell them not to go to Israel the way Lana Del Rey fans did earlier this year when she announced she would be performing there. But what happens when you refuse to hold that artist accountable? When a celebrity in a position of power stretches the limits of their fan base's loyalty? Skipping down. Kanye visited the White House on Thursday to deliver a soliloquy in the Oval Office in front of Trump and the White House press pool. During the meeting, members of the press stood facing Kanye with their camera lenses pointed at a man who was once a revered rapper and producer. West said in part, quote, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and connected with a neuropsychologist. He looked at my brain. I will go ahead and drop bombs for us. 98% on IQ test, 75% of all human beings, 8 numbers backwards. I'm going to work on that one. He said I actually wasn't bipolar. I had sleep deprivation that can cause dementia 10 to 20 years from now where I wouldn't remember my son's name. Another thing is black people have a problem with the word again because time is a myth. These are all quotes from him from that press conference. Kanye is doing these things because he can. He wasn't called out in the Fader's office. This was another media office that he just randomly showed up and spouted a bunch of nonsense. Celebrities have made attempts to reach out to him or criticize him on social media, but these efforts evidently haven't stuck. The only time someone has directly opposed Kanye to his face and on camera was in May 2018 when Van Lathan of TMZ confronted him. Kanye had just made his slavery comment, where he thought the amendment should be overturned, in front of the TMZ newsroom. Quote, "Do you feel like I'm thinking free and feeling free?" West asked those in the newsroom. And, quote, "I actually don't think you're thinking anything," Lathan said. "I think what you're doing right now is actually the absence of thought." While what he said took some courage, it's important to realize Van still didn't fully hold Kanye accountable. Telling someone that they have morphed into something that isn't real and what they're doing is the absence of thought is generously assuming a lot. Trump and his policies are real. Wearing a MAGA hat when you know what it represents is real and requires thought. There are no excuses left for Kanye. The more we continue to do so, the more we create an environment where Kanye will never be held accountable for what he does. Van isn't alone in his inability to fully hold Kanye accountable. Most of us are partly guilty. Every time Kanye does something, people react with an, "Oh my God, Kanye." Rochelle Riley, columnist for the Detroit Free Press, told her followers, "For those imploring me to write about Kanye West, I will not. Watching someone have a nervous breakdown in real time is worse than watching a car accident. People must stop interviewing West and instead encourage him to get help or sell albums another way." Others were not so forgiving. Suzette Hackney wrote Wednesday in the Indianapolis Star, "What really struck me is the length West will go to get attention. It's vile. He will say anything, wear anything, tweet anything, do anything, just to be in the public eye. That is narcissism at its finest. This is especially difficult within the black community, where Kanye for so long gave a voice to a lot of us." And listeners, please note that Casey, I'm not speaking for that community. These are the words of the article's author, Malcolm Aime Musoni. Just to be clear on that. Quote, "Kanye was one of us. And now, even as he does inexcusable things, we let him slide, like the weird uncle at the barbecue who says something problematic. We can't cancel family. But what's happening is that he's taking advantage of that role, and it's not acceptable. Kanye has said so many irresponsible and harmful things that the blame has to start and end with the man himself. Kanye could link up with Jay-Z again and make Watch the Throne 2, and it still wouldn't be good enough to reverse the damage he's done to the culture. Kanye cannot return from this. As hard as it is for fans to accept, there's no more separating the art from the artist. The art is made by the artist. Now is the time to realize this and act," end quote. So these are two almost polar opposite takes on the same person, the same problem. So let's help our listeners understand as best as we can, considering this is a subjective call. When is it time to show understanding and less rigor? And when is it tough love time for people in these situations? And Dr. Mathis, I'm going to break this to you.
Okay. Well, you know, that's a very good question, and sometimes difficult to answer. I mean, my stance on most of this is we are all responsible for what we do, and we all need to be held accountable, and that's my bottom line. However, having said that, you know, there are certain folks for whom that's going to be very difficult. You get somebody who has a very severe intellectual disability, which is what used to be called mental retardation. So you got somebody who is either profoundly or severely mentally retarded, it's going to be real hard to hold them accountable for their stuff because they're just not operating with a full brain. right? If you get some people who are very, very low on the totem pole in the autism spectrum disorders, same scenario, right? This, to me, is a different situation because you've got somebody who has a mental illness, who's been told he has a mental illness, and simply refuses to maintain his medication. And that, by the way, if he really does have bipolar disorder, and since I didn't examine him, I can't say whether he does or doesn't, but let's just assume for a minute that he does, right? It is pretty common behavior for bipolars to get off their meds. They start feeling better. They stop taking their meds. They get high to a degree because the meds kind of inhibit their mania, and they like feeling manicky and high and woohoo. So they quit taking them altogether or almost quit taking them, and then, of course, they relapse back. They get into trouble. They get put in jail or prison or the hospital or whatever, and they get back on their meds, and they're, oh, I'm so sorry. But it's a revolving door for these folks. It's really – they're notorious for that. And so for those kind of behaviors, I don't really have a lot of sympathy because they know they're sick. They choose not to take their meds that would help them. I just don't have any sympathy for that stuff. You know, it's ludicrous. That's a different scenario to me than somebody who literally cannot. You have brain damage and you can't do certain things. That's a whole different ballgame for me. Or somebody who doesn't realize they have serious mental illness for what I don't know how the hell that would happen, but there's people out there who probably don't. And, you know, you can't fix it if you don't know you got it. And then there's a very small group of people who can't afford it, can't afford to get the help they need. Actually, it's probably bigger than a small group who can't afford to get the help they need.
It's pretty big now.
Yeah, that's what she said. Oh, wait a minute, you just did. Ooh, anyway.
We're not doing that show
yeah. today. Yeah, really. We're not talking about that tonight. Keep your hands to yourself. So, you know, there's all these confabulating factors, but for folks who know they have it and who just choose not to do anything about it, and that's the vast majority of people, it's been my experience. You know, people come into my office and we do, you know how compulsive I am with the testing. Well, I'm compulsive with everything, but that's another story. And you got to own up to your shit, right? What can I say? But, you know, they come in, they get the testing, they get the evaluation, and then they go, well, no, that's not right. Or, well, you know, I'm just not going to do that. Okay. Then you're going to suffer the natural and logical consequences from your actions. And I think that's what needs to happen in this situation.
Yeah. Okay, that's
fair. That's my take on it. How do you know when it's time to put the hammer down? When you've tried to be rational and reasonable with folks, when they know they have an issue and they just refuse to address it, or they try to, you know, use their money or their fame or their looks or their political power or whatever to avoid it. And I don't have a lot of time for that. And I think all these people ought to be held accountable for their stuff, probably more so because they're in the public eye. And their behaviors are impacting. Other people are seeing that going, well, hell. You know, I mean, if half the people did some of the crap that some of these folks do, some of these celebrities do, I mean, they would be under the jail.
Yeah.
You know, people would not be rushing out to get their autograph.
Yeah.
You know?
Fair enough. Okay. So the next part I want to talk about is what I have called pathological functionality. That's not a medical term. That's my thing. This part is other examples and discussions of mental illnesses, physical illnesses, and other pathologies that drastically alter behavior and the cogency to address it. So in order to be a responsible, and in other words, I know this is jargony, but response-able adult, accountable for oneself and well-being, one has to have and be able to execute specific skills and functions. And specifically in this context of policing yourself, taking care of yourself, asking for help, knowing when there's something wrong with you. So I identified five things. There could be more. First, be able to understand what various conditions and illnesses are, at least on a basic level. You don't have to be a doctor, but you should be able to have a rough idea. Number two, be able to know what are considered abnormal symptoms and conditions that merit professional attention, such as what merits an ER trip, versus an office visit versus the drugstore or what may be nothing of concern. So you need to have some ability to police that and understand that. Number three, where to go for information and assistance, basic types of caregivers and how to find them, and also just information on the internet, some idea of what you're looking for. Your average neurotypical person, essentially in control of themselves, knows these things. So in order to handle this like a functioning adult, you need these skills. Number four, be able to keep a basic calendar, appointment system, and communication system to arrange appointments. Be sure not to miss them. Be sure to come prepared and tend to other matters we may consider obvious, like asking for time off work to take care of things, making sure you have transportation, making sure you have a means of payment. These may seem grossly oversimplified, but if somebody's in the middle of their pathology, sometimes they're either screw-offs and don't take care of it, or sometimes they're not really with it enough to think of all that being involved. All they think of is, oh, I don't feel good, and that's all the thought they put in. So you need to be able to do better than that in order to handle those things. And number five, in a general sense, be proactive by nature in even remembering these are necessary to maintain on a regular basis and seek out a method to do so. And this is like we take care of our physical bodies and we go get checkups and, you know, we do our laundry so we have something to put on our bodies and we feed our bodies and go to the restroom and all that. And this is the same kind of thing, but for our mental health. And so functioning neurotypical adults who are capable of taking care of themselves and being independent realize that every so often you get a check on this stuff. And some people may lack that skill. And that's part of what we're talking about tonight. So the issue at which we're gesturing is that many adults pathologically struggle with these seemingly obvious and simple tasks, often due to symptoms of their condition. When we criticize someone for not taking care of these matters appropriately, we must be cautious about seeing their situation through the mindset of someone who does not have the failings of many of the mentioned conditions. There's a spectrum of people under, and I don't mean this in the autism spectrum, I mean just the normal word. There's a spectrum of people under the influence of a variety of reality-affecting and functionality-affecting disorders. We want to take a look now at several kinds of pathologies that can distort one's ability to understand reality and societal expectations and standards. Also, at those which can inhibit one's ability to functionally do the kind of diligence, self-care, and responsibility that is needed to handle these matters. In the next section, we will talk more in depth about our general obligations to tend to our own mental health in spite of its effects, and I mean that in section three. So right now, we will talk about the extent to which various specific pathologies can render the patient nearly unable or at least deeply impaired to properly address their own mental illness and the consequences it may cause. So here is a list of some conditions relevant here. And while I read these off, Dr. Mathis, if you want to add any, that's perfectly fine. I don't know if you want to go through the whole list or if you want to discuss them one at a time, or how do you feel about that?
What I would say is go ahead and give your list, and then I'll address them one at a time. And actually, there's one I definitely want to add there that's not here.
Okay, that's fine. All right, so here's the list that I came up with, and we will discuss and add to it as necessary. ADHD and attention disorders, anxiety disorders and phobias, ASD and spectrum disorders, and this one is choice, not a pathology, but can be exacerbated by a pathology. Choosing not to take meds or otherwise follow a doctor's orders outside of as a reaction to one's pathology, like if you're paranoid or something. Conditions that do not impair cognizance or perception of reality, such as cluster B issues, anger issues, etc. They don't really affect your ability to know that you're sick and you should go see someone. Dementia, Alzheimer's, senility, other memory and reality deteriorations. Language or communication impairments, other cognitive impairments, and schizophrenia, paranoia, or delusions. And here I will check in with you to see what else you'd like to add, and then we can discuss these.
Well, it's funny because cluster B personality disorders are one of the big ones I was going to add, because those people really do have distorted perceptions of reality. It's not in the clinical sense of they're not crazy crazy, but they certainly distort information significantly in their head, both emotional and cognitive.
Would you say that the cluster Bs are actually incapable of realizing that they have a problem, or they just excuse it or, you know, explain it away?
They don't want to look at it because it's threatening.
Okay. But they do realize there's something to not look at.
Some of them don't really want to even admit they have a problem. Some of them will admit they have an issue, but then they'll use it as an excuse for their misbehavior, or they won't look at it because they're totally afraid that if they look at it, they're going to realize how horrible they are and they're not going to be able to change it. So it's more of a fear factor thing.
Got it. Okay. Anything else you want to add on the rest of the list? Yeah, go ahead.
The other one I was going to add is post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, very good one. Yes, yes.
Right. And you probably thought you were addressing that with the anxieties, which under the old ESM, you would have been. But in DSM, So in DSM 5, which, as you know, came out in 2013, they moved the PTSD to its own category now. So it's PTSD and other trauma-related disorders is in its own category. But let's face it, folks, it's basically an anxiety-based disorder. So, yeah.
Well,
okay,
you know,
so let me just talk.
PTSD as well. You and I have separate rants about that, too.
Yeah, and you know, and that does, I mean, if you have PTSD early enough, you know, general rule of thumb is the earlier you have the set of traumas that overload your brain where you can no longer, you know, it can't cope anymore. The earlier you have that, the more severe the traumas are, the more out of the blue they come, the more they're related to important people in your life, the less support you have, and the earlier in your life they occur, they actually cause the brain to miswire. And so if you start getting uber traumas prior to age 9 or 10, you're in big trouble, especially if they're severe and especially if they're repeated and especially if they involve close relationships. So, you know, you're being physically or emotionally or sexually abused on a repeated basis by uncles, you know, brothers, parents, whatever, you know, if you look at most of the, well, I won't say most, but a lot of the serial killers and rapists, they had pretty amazingly bad childhood, traumatic childhoods. And if you have the trauma severe enough, even if you don't revert to a cluster B personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder, which used to be called multiple personalities, it impairs your ability to look at relationships. And there's a pretty good bit of data that says that if you have a significant amount of traumas prior to a certain age and have all these other qualifications, that you will probably not have any normal relationships for the rest of your life unless you get in very intense therapy for a long period of time to rewire your brain. So that's a big one. Yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, and
you're right. I did kind of think that anxiety disorders and was going to cover that, but I can kind of see how it would have its own little thing, too.
Yeah, but they are but you're right. They're basically anxiety-based disorders. There's no question about it. Absolutely. There's also a form of depression. I don't see it real often, but it's basically a form that you become so depressed, and this is not like the Johnny Carson joke. How depressed were they? But you become so depressed that you actually become temporarily psychotic. And it's pretty rare, but to quote Judy Tenuta, it could happen.
It could happen.
But it's pretty rare. And obviously, those are temporary conditions.
In people that are bipolar, like when they're in their depressive phase, does it ever get that bad?
You can just have regular depression, just severe chronic major depression, and have it for a really, 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 really long period of time that you can trace back to childhood because you have. Let's say you have a propensity for depression because of your genetic loading, and you can trace your depression back to childhood, and it's just gotten considerably worse over the years, and you've had some bad breaks and yada yada, you can temporarily become psychotic for a short period of time. Usually it's a period of time and your brain kind of clears up and you go, oh, wait a minute, I was crazy for a moment. You know, but and I've actually only seen cases that I've never actually seen a walking, talking person in my office do that. But I do know there's a history of that and that there's some literature out there that speaks to that. And there's a category in DSM for that. So you got to be pretty bad for that to happen. Yeah, it has to be pretty chronic and pretty severe. All right. So the ADHD people just have a lot of functional issues that they have to overcome. And I'm not brushing it under the rug like, oh, it's not the big of a deal, because it's a real big deal. Primary amongst them is the abstract reasoning / executive function deficits that they have pretty much lifelong. And that's a really toughie. Now, they can do workarounds, but most of the time they need help figuring out the workarounds. And once they practice the workarounds and do them on a consistent basis, then they can look like they're doing them when they're really not. But that's a limiting, it's a disorder that limits the sufferer if they don't get a lot of, you know, coaching on how to get around that stuff. The anxiety disorders impact you only, and the phobias, obviously, they're going to limit your functionality. Yeah, again, with a chronic anxiety disorder, and this is kind of the bad news for anxiety disorders, that if you have an anxiety disorder for longer than 2 years, which is considered quote-unquote chronic, if you think about anxiety disorders, they take a lot of energy to buttress against, and because of that, it drains your body of energy. And if you have an anxiety disorder for 2 or more years, the likelihood of you also having a comorbid depression disorder is really high. So now you have two disorders in one. And when that happens, of course, the medications, and I can watch way too many late night retro TV shows. When you have that, you have an increased risk of, you know, having to take multiple medications if you're going to a medication route, and then doing something so the medications don't interfere with each other, and it just becomes really a mess. In my personal opinion, you're much smarter handling them holistically than you are medicationally and therapeutically than you are medicationally. The autism spectrum disorders definitely put a limit on somebody's social awareness and social functionality, if you will. But again, if you catch it early, you can teach those folks how to look like they're being social even when they're not. And in fact, I had a kid in my office, this was, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, who also had ADHD, had a comorbid ADHD condition. And it was a teenager, and the mom was bringing this teenager in to get re-upped for their ADHD so they could get certified through the rest of high school and yada, yada. And the kid was really cute, and most of the autism spectrum people I see are kind of reactionary, kind of angry, kind of not very nice people, and I don't say that to slam them. It's just that's been my experience with them. And this particular individual was the complete diametric opposite, and this was like please and thank you, and I was just like, holy moly, this kid's got manners. But what was really cute was the kid was doing the testing and kind of looking around the room and kind of spacing out like a lot of, you know, Asperger, what used to be called Asperger / autistic kids do. And the kid caught himself and went, oh, my gosh, I'm sorry, I'm supposed to be looking at you. And he turned to look at me. And, of course, he was staring like a laser beam at me trying to be social. It was so cute. So, you know, obviously folks with autism spectrum problems can be trained to do stuff. Sometimes it's a little extreme, but they can certainly be trained to do the social stuff. And this particular kid had a lot of really good manners and stuff. It's just certain social things were more difficult for this person. That's just dumber than dog poop. That's just being an anapable. Oh, sorry, folks. That's Greek for stupidly hard-headed. I know it's Greek to them, right? Ba-doop. Okay.
It's all Greek to them.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, well, there you go. So, you know, the dementia, certainly, if you have any sort of dementias, whether the dementias of the Alzheimer's types or the senility dementias or anything, obviously those are going to cause serious memory impairment and in some cases reality testing problems. Language and communication impairments depends on how severe they are. So, for example, one of the language disorders that I have is anomia. It's considered, you know, sort of a language / communication disorder. learning disorder where I can't remember names of things. So one minute I'll remember the term salt and pepper shaker, and the next minute I'll go, pass me those thingies over there, or jiggies, or thingamabobbies, or whatchamacallums, or whatever, and dillies, you know. And I'm really not trying to be cute and funny. I really, just temporarily, it's like my brain threw a blanket over the word and went, nah, 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 you know, and I literally can't remember the word. It's so embarrassing. And you're like, Bivis, those like things over there and stuff. Yeah. And I'm like that with people's names too. So it's just, it's really bad. So, you know, what I've tried to do is...
And I giggle because I have a similar reflection since my stroke.
So well, there you go. So what I've done is I've remembered some people's names, and this is compounded by the fact that I don't have any visual memory skills either, so that makes it even worse. So what I do is I try to pair somebody's name with a song lyric I know, or with a member of a band whose name I can remember because it's paired with a song lyric or a specific song they do, or a particular instrument they play that I'm a fan of or whatever. And so I have to go around my elbow to get to my assets when I'm remembering this kind of stuff. So I have to go way out of my way to overcome that. But most of the time I'm successful, and sometimes not so much. definitely the schizophrenia, delusional disorder stuff. Yeah, those folks in the vernacular of the South, them boys ain't right. And they can certainly function in most cases if they're on the right medications, the right dosage, but kind of like the bipolars, they don't really like staying on their meds, and partially because of the side effects. And I have to say, I really don't blame them, because when you're on a medication like lithium carbonate for bipolar disorder, or certain like Haldol or Stelazine, Thorazine, although a lot of the newer antipsychotics aren't as bad about this, you can gain as much as 80 or 90 pounds. And, you know, that would have a very deleterious impact on my desires to continue taking a medication that made me fat, just taking it through no fault of my own. So I get it. But the reality is, if you don't take that stuff, you're really not very functional. And while most schizophrenia folks and delusional disorder folks aren't dangerous, there is a small set of those folks who are. And some of those folks are the people you read about, you know, taking Uzis to the mall, thinking they're killing aliens in human body kind of thing.
Yeah.
But those folks are pretty rare.
Thankfully.
Okay, so that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All right. Thank you, Emily Latella. Okay, so...
Danger species.
Yeah. So, in the next section, I want to talk about, some people may be inclined to dismiss West as a valid or relevant example because of his celebrity status, but these disorders can affect someone in any walk of life. Celebrities do often get handled differently for many reasons. They typically can afford pricier help, though some bankrupt themselves with their antics. Their handler or manager is protecting their image as an investment, etc. So I wanted to list some other celebrities with similar experiences. Please note that there is represented a wide variety of outcomes for more or less the same rough diagnosis. So here are just a few notable celebrities and public figures with a somewhat varied and dynamic range of behaviors and incidents of mania or depression. Most sought help, some after public meltdowns or legal trouble. A few never got help for various reasons. The point is to show other celebrities with similar problems to Kanye West. First one is Axl Rose, who's bipolar, unnamed type. Rose has denied his professionally done diagnosis. He has been on lithium and in anger management programs. His status on this is currently unknown. Astronaut Buzz Aldrin. Aldrin was said to be bipolar. The fame of his space career drove him to drink and have depressive episodes. He wasn't really known for mania. He stayed sober for over 30 years at the time when he passed away. Carrie Fisher, bipolar, unnamed, probably type 2 with hypomania. Had drug and drinking problems, but not that many public displays. Got help when she became a parent. Eventually became a vehement advocate for mental health destigmatization until her death. Catherine Zeta-Jones, bipolar 2. She was not prone to having meltdowns in public, privately chose to get help. Demi Lovato, bipolar type unnamed, had minor episodes in the press, first learned of her pathology in rehab, and eventually sought help for it. She's one of those people we talked about earlier who knew something was the matter but had no idea what it was until they forced her into rehab and then someone finally told her, or I guess nobody diagnosed it before that. DMX, who is a rapper, has talked about having manic depression in his songs, and I own some of his albums, so yet that is a constant theme. He has had multiple manic episodes, including getting arrested for impersonating the FBI at an airport. I remember that one. X, you really got to calm down. Jean-Claude Van Damme has rapid cycling bipolar disorder. He's been through multiple divorces, some for spousal abuse, and he's had drug problems. He may have been bipolar since childhood, but went undiagnosed for decades until drug arrests in his 30s and eventually sought help. Kurt Cobain from Nirvana, who may have had ADHD as a child, was diagnosed with bipolar disorder as an adult, had tried to kill himself many times before dying of a self-inflicted gunshot wound at 27. Linda Hamilton, bipolar disorder unnamed, had substance abuse issues for 20-some-odd years, had problems since childhood, and tried for years for a correct diagnosis and help. Mariah Carey, who is bipolar too, did not have disaster episodes and chose to get help. Mel Gibson talked about his bipolar disorder in a 2002 documentary. Some of his recent brushes with the law may have been the result of his illness. Scott Stapp, the front man for the band Creed, has bipolar unnamed. He had major episodes of mania, paranoia, and substance abuse and eventually sought help. He's now in a 12-step program and basically clean. Sinead O'Connor, bipolar unnamed. Multiple public meltdowns, including going missing and thought suicidal just a few years ago. And I mean literally less than three. Because I remember on social media when people were looking for her. Only sought help recently and is in an unknown status with all this. And last one, Vivian Leigh from Gone with the Wind, bipolar unnamed. Leigh was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and an unpredictable behavior eventually ruined her professional reputation and destroyed her marriage to Laurence Olivier. Quote, in her day, there were no pills. There were no clinics. There were no publicists. There was nobody between Vivian and an outside world which she found chilly, hostile, and sometimes because of her mental state could not cope with, said her friend Sheridan Morley in a BBC documentary. The takeaway from this list is to see the variety of behaviors and outcomes from other people that are comparable to Kanye West mentioned earlier. Everyone is different, but also it shows that even others under the same pressures of fame and celebrity usually can be helped. There are exceptions, obviously, but the point remains. We are only gesturing at West as a well-known current news representation of a larger ongoing problem, both for public figures and everyday people. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis.
I'm good, thanks.
Okay. So the next part is responsibility, accountability, culpability, and pragmatism. And these are, to a large extent, interchangeable in this context. At what point do we, should we, or even can we intervene to save someone from themselves? Beyond the courts and the doctors, what if the person is not functional enough to address their own problems or even be alarmed enough to recognize a problem exists and want to address it? In the last section, we pointed out some specific diagnoses and how they can interfere with a person's ability to recognize personal problems and to pursue help for them. Let's now talk in depth about the general blanket societal and social obligations that each of us have to tend to our own mental health issues, problems, concerns, and pathologies. We're not discussing those who are fully or mostly aware of their diagnosis and who then use that as an excuse not to handle their business. And I mean this in a sense with, you know, clear thought. It's just avoidance and excuses. we're looking at that precipice between persons whose mental illness renders them flat out unable to do the necessary self-care, and persons who are deeply impaired in some way or several ways, yet are not yet to a medical or legal standard cutoff requiring supervisory or clinical intervention. This is something deeply painful and difficult for friends and family members to know how is best to react. For some, they feel powerless to stop the seeming destruction of someone they love. For others, this person's pathology may have had consequences that deeply wounded those around them, so now it's difficult to feel much sympathy. And yet the person remains in crisis and distress, and now without a support system, possibly of their own doing. At the end of the day, if everyone leaves the person to destroy themselves, even that will eventually in part become someone else's problem by law, default, and force. So how do we navigate this with the afflicted person or on behalf of them? And I will check in with you on that part, Dr. Mathis.
Well, it's really funny that you say that, because you've just described my father.
Yeah.
Who was...
I kind of knew that when I said it.
Well, there you go. I mean, you know, he, for those of you who don't know, I mean, most people who saw him on the outside saw this great guy who was, you know, jovial and friendly and all, but he had a great facade, and like most cluster Bs, he had a great... persona that he could portray for short periods of time where people didn't see how severe his pathology was. And my mom and I both tried to get him help. You know, we did everything from screaming and yelling and threatening to begging and pleading and crying and cajoling and being rational. At the end of the day, he just didn't want to get help. He just did, you know, well, that's your problem. So my take on all this is, if somebody's dumb enough not to get, or obstinate enough not, because it was, my dad wasn't dumb, not to get help, you know, my comeback is let them suffer the natural and logical consequences of their actions. You know, you can't, we're not in a society that you can force somebody to get help if they don't want to, unless they are a clear and present danger to themselves and or other people. And states have been very loath to lower that cutoff point. So, I mean, you have to be really, really dysfunctional to get 1013'd. Or to be considered quote-unquote incompetent. I've seen some pretty crazy things with some of the my patients' relatives that tried to get them 1013, and the courts are very, very loath to do that. So, I mean, it is a serious problem if you've got somebody with serious mental illness that doesn't want to get help. And they definitely have a deleterious impact on other people's lives. There's no way around it. The best thing I can say is, you know, if you encourage somebody and give them the stuff and they don't do it, and I know this sounds heartless, and I don't mean for it to, you really need to just leave them to their own devices and protect your own assets, because if you get too involved with them, they're going to bring you down with their crap.
And just for the benefit of our listeners who don't know, the 1013 designation, is that basically where they are involuntarily committed?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Or?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that.
I just want to make sure I'm using
this is what happens when you're a nerd.
No,
this is what happens when you're a nerd. You forget that, you know, you're a nerd and other people aren't. my own personal pathology, among many. 1013 is involuntary commitment. You're basically hospitalizing somebody against their will for a 72-hour period for observation and testing.
Okay, so it's like the non-suicidal version of the Baker Act, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
You're 1013.
Yep. All righty.
That's cool. The legal statute. That's why they call it 1013.
Okay. As opposed to police code, I'll have to go look up what 1013 is on the police
code. Police code
they don't use it.
The police code is 5150 for crazy person, and 1013 for we're gonna involuntarily commit this person. So they could have a 5150 that doesn't meet the 1013 qualifications.
I think that's why they stopped using 10 code a few years ago.
Which is, by the way, why the Van Halen album that introduced Sammy Hagar, the 5150, that's what that code comes from.
Oh. Well, the more you know. I did not know that one. Okay, cool.
There you go.
Right,
another
so
trivia
the,
for
the
you.
The last part we want to talk about is Section 4 is boundaries and intervention, which is kind of a segue from what we were just talking about.
Yep.
How to decide boundaries for yourself regarding others in your life who appear to need intervention, when it is appropriate to try to step in, when one should just leave the person to the consequences, and how to practically do both. It's painful and difficult for many people to face the fact of self-determination, that people they may love and care about just willfully do not prioritize the same things when it comes to their own lives, self-care, and well-being. And that unless they are to the point of requiring legal or medical guardianship, it's their decision to make, and they may have the exact same rage and resentments as any of us if that choice is forcibly taken away before that was humane and necessary. They may or they may not be fully capable of determining and considering all of the relevant facts in that decision, but it is still theirs to make. Courts, doctors, and other institutions have professional guidelines for when it's time to disregard those decisions. And we are dealing with the side of the proverbial line before that moment has been reached. And yes, this can mean that your loved one may not go get the help they need when you think they need it. And sometimes you may even be correct. This is a delicate, subjective, and sensitive process, and it is so easy to guess incorrectly. And I'm going to check in with you on that part, Dr. Mathis.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason the courts are very loath to do anything unless there is, like, so much overwhelming evidence that this person is not going to make it without some sort of intervention. And it is a delicate subject, and it is sad, very, very sad, both for the sufferer and for the, if you will, the unintentional victims of the sufferer's suffering, which are often family members and friends. So what I'd say is, you know, if it's somebody you care about, try to get them help. And if you can't get them help and, you know, they're just refusing to do that, then make sure that you're covered. Make sure that their behavior isn't going to negatively impact you. And as best you can, disconnect yourself from them, because sooner or later they're going to have a fall. And if they have a fall and recognize they have a fall and recognize they need help and go after help, you can always go back and help them out. You don't have to stay away or shake fingers and go, I told you so. I mean, you know, this is not the time for that kind of crap. You know, you want to be supportive of them if they finally get a clue and, you know, have a brain cell. And if they do that, then you need to help them get the help they need if they are willing, and as long as they're willing to do it and cooperate. You know, but if they can't, you need to make sure that you're covering your own stuff, because you don't want their behavior to contaminate yours.
Absolutely. Okay, so it is just a little after midnight, and with that, this concludes our show on He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, Pathological Functionality. We hope that our listeners can better understand their relationship with people both personally close and public figures of influence who have pathologies that can interfere with their own sense of boundaries and responsibilities. We hope we have helped our listeners to have a better sense of making a judgment call on when to intervene and when to protect yourself, sometimes by distancing yourselves. Dr. Mathis, is there anything else that you would like to add in closing?
No, I would just like to say this is a toughie, and, you know, it's something that we all struggle with. All of us, I'm sure, can name a person in our lives that we've have now or have had that has this kind of stuff going on. And, you know, I just want to once again encourage folks to really take care of yourself if somebody's being, you know, consistently pathological and refusing to get help, because the only thing that's going to happen is they're going to take both of you down. And sometimes that requires distancing yourself from that person, both physically and emotionally, which is what I did with my dad, you know. And, you know, it wasn't like it was a decision I came to easily, but it was something I had to do for my own sense of sanity and, you know, making myself less dysfunctional over his crap. Right.
Yeah. Fair enough. So hopefully that is helpful to you guys in dealing with this. And hopefully also you absorb that, you know, we don't really have any really straightforward one size fits all answers for this. So if that's how you're kind of feeling about it, that's absolutely accurate, unfortunately. But hopefully some of the things we said tonight can help you at least kind of make a really good guess about how you should handle it. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, I want to thank our listeners this evening, and appreciation also to those of you who join us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we will see you guys in 2 weeks on Halloween Wednesday, October 31st at 11 p.m. EDT. right here on blogtalkradio.com. So please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.